My name is Caroline Cape, and today I'm interviewing Jack Farley, a past public advocate for the Department of Public Advocacy. We are at the Marriott Hotel in Louisville, Kentucky. It is June 5th, 2012, and this interview with Mr. Farley is in regards to the history of the Department of Public Advocacy, as well as his involvement and experiences within the agency.
I was appointed to be the public advocate in early 1975, and I served until October of 1983. Governor Julian Carroll appointed me. Governor Wendell Ford had gone to the U.S. Senate as a senator from Kentucky, and Governor Carroll had been the lieutenant governor, and he succeeded to the office, and then he appointed me in the spring. And his assistant at that time that I dealt with mostly was Terry McBrayer from Ashland, Kentucky. We also talked a lot, I think, in those early days to Jerry Abramson, who at that time was in the, I think, if I recall correctly, either then or later, was governor's legal counsel at that time. The interesting thing about the appointment was I was in private practice struggling along from day to day, and I had been of late in the office of Dan Jack Combs, a lawyer there in Pikeville, my home, and in Pike County. But Terry McBrayer said it was imperative that I report to Frankfurt by March the 1st. That means my whatever feeble little law practice I had to be ended by March the 1st and letters sent out, because Tony Wilhoit, the first public defender, had left and was doing things on his own situation. And so I closed up shop and we moved to Frankfurt by March the 1st of 1975. Also, great credit is due to Ernie Lewis, who, with great foresight, in the fall of 1983, when I left, wrote an article in the newsletter of the Advocate for the department and summarized very vividly a lot of the aspects that I've referred to you about, things that have been accomplished. And you probably have to look at that article in depth to know some of the details that I probably will leave out. At the time, I felt called to do it. I felt like the Lord was leading me in that direction, and I've always wished that I had told the Courier-Journal reporter when he called me on the phone, why do you want to do this? You've been in the Chamber of Commerce as director in Pike County. Are you really qualified to do this? I learned real quickly not to rise to the bait of a reporter's question. I should have said, well, I felt called by the Lord to do it, and that surely would have made headlines. But I told him, I said, I've wanted to do that. From law school on, I've been interested in service. I went to law school in Washington, D.C. at the Washington College of Law of the American University. And at the time, it still remembered its Methodist church leanings and founding issues and so on. And so there was a great deal of emphasis on service. And I felt like that I could do some of this. Plus, I had been a local public defender for quite some time. And I had seen and learned firsthand how ill-trained, or how much lack of training that I had. I'd been on the federal public defender list. Mm-hmm. I'd been appointed in federal court. And my first big appointment in circuit court in Pike County by Judge Venters, E.N. Venters, appointed me to defend a young man on a murder-for-hire case. Three young men accused of killing the wife of a man who allegedly hired them to kill her because he was tired of her. Mm-hmm. And that was my case. And I realized very quickly when I came up against Paul Runyon, who was a way back connected cousin of mine at Runyon's, or we were connected some time back, that I was ill-prepared to do that case. And that case, if some of you all recall, haunted us for a long time thereafter because of issues and concerns about it. The vision for DPA, or at the Public Advocacy Office as it later became, I saw pretty soon and early on that we really needed to implement Argersinger versus Hamlin, which was the right to counsel defined by the Supreme Court, that we really needed effective assistance of counsel, and that the appointed system of saying, here, young Jones, come up here, lawyer, the court summoning a lawyer to come up to the front of the bar and say, you're going to represent this person. Probably within the realm of the tradition of the law and of being a lawyer, but did not necessarily mean that person was going to get effective assistance of counsel, because the lawyer that was appointed may or may not have had any experience, just like I did not have any experience, and certainly not sufficient experience to represent a person in a serious capital felony case. And so we needed a better system, I felt like, than the appointed counsel. We had a list, or if we didn't have at that time, later we'd have a list of volunteers, of lawyers. At least we did improve to the point that lawyers who wanted to do this work would put their name on a list. But in those early days before Bradshaw v. Ball, you know, they didn't get paid. So fortunately for us, Kentucky was one of the leaders I think it was in 72, wasn't it, when Bradshaw v. Ball was passed? 71, okay. And that said it was a deprivation of property without due process of law to appoint a lawyer and require the lawyer to serve, even though the profession regarded it as a responsibility for lawyers. I could see that we were not getting effective assistance. So I don't know that I had a vision when I first started in 75, but pretty quickly I began to see, based on that experience, and then the reports as they came in from throughout the state about the appointed system of representation, that was not the best. Also, we were members early on, if I recall, of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association, and they had a lot of folks that were publications and other kinds of things that were teaching us that probably full-time public defenders were what was needed in order to get a more systematic approach, a more professional approach, a better trained approach to providing, because this was a fairly esoteric area of practice. I mean, it was not a garden variety thing to represent a person accused of a felony, where they may go and spend a lifetime or even be executed. You could not just rise up and one day do that. You had to have preparation and training. And so we began to search for ways for greater funding, and you weren't even probably alive at that time. We had a thing the feds had passed called the LEAA, which stands for Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. And after the turmoil of 1968, the political turmoil, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, and the burning of blocks of Washington, D.C., they burned more than 500 city blocks in Washington, D.C., where I lived in 67. One of the reasons I came home to Eastern Kentucky. So the point of all that was the LEAA was later created, and their main penchant seemed to me to be funding things like water cannon to take care of all this turmoil in the streets that we were having, and to control all these people that were rioting and concerned. And they had roving bands of federales that would go up and down with water cannons. But they had a provision somewhere in that legislation. Somebody ferreted out, probably Ed Monahan or somebody a whole lot smarter than me, or Ernie Lewis, that said there was some provision for funding for public defenders. And so we made application, and then we repeated an application, and I think we ended up getting over $1 million from the feds for the creation of full-time offices, and that came later. Mm-hmm. But gradually that began to be developed, and we began to build, and obviously, I hopefully hope it wasn't too parochial of me since I was from Eastern Kentucky, and I knew firsthand the greatest need, that's where I started with regard to full-time offices, to try to have full-time offices funding. And then the big transition issue then was when that federal funding dried up, we had to go to the legislature and try to get funding. And for a while, as Ernie remarks in the article, and I had forgotten this, the General Assembly did fund some of those. But during the time that I was there, we were never able to complete the whole system. It was only, I think, Ernie, was it in your time that you finally got funding for most of the full-time?
2005 it was finished.
2005, think of that. From 83 to 2005 before we were able to fund full-time defenders all over the Kentucky. In the earliest day, we had to depend on the local fiscal, F-I-S-C-A-L, fiscal court, which in the days, I don't know whether it's still that way in Kentucky or not, but it may well be. The local legislative body of each county was the fiscal court, and they were magistrates. In my home county, there were justices of the peace. They had a judicial function, and they also had a legislative function at the local or county level. And they gathered together, and they would set up funding, provide funding. They had the taxing authority. They would provide funding at the local level. And the way the legislation, the early legislation was written, was we had to go to those people and ask them to provide funding for these local systems as we gradually began. We were trying to carry out Bradshaw v. Ball and have some money to pay these assigned counsel in the early days. And so we were effectively going to the local county, the local fiscal court. The county judge was the chief executive and the leader of the fiscal court. And we would make a presentation to them and say, we need you to provide funding to help pay for public defenders. And the common complaint that I got, and we all got, was the magistrate would say, you mean to tell me, Farley, you want me to provide, want us to provide taxpayer money to pay for representation of this person who's stolen my chickens? And I would have to say, yes, sir, that's what I'm asking you for. And I did. And we went all over the 120 counties. I don't know whether I got to all 120 counties, but I went to a lot of them asking them to put up money to fund this system at the local level, because funding from the legislature was totally inadequate. What was it, $1 million or $2 million initially, or some really, really low sum, you know? And the challenge, the biggest challenge, besides that kind of opposition, was apathy. People just did not see the need, did not understand why it was necessary, as we have learned so vividly, recreated and emphasized for us today at this wonderful conference we've been enjoying today. Was it June the 6th, yes. June the 5th of 2012? We now know how important the right to counsel is. Then it was just as important, but people just didn't realize it. So the biggest issue you had to run into was trying to educate people, not only fiscal court members, but the public as well, about how important it was to provide. The other thing from the legislative standpoint, I think people were philosophically opposed. I ran into some of this in the legislature, opposed to funding both sides of the system. They were well understood they had to fund the court system, had to have that, and they thoroughly understood the idea that they had to have the prosecutors. But our idea was, well, if you have the prosecutors, then you have to have the defense counsel in order to have a fair trial. And selling that and teaching that was difficult in those early days. Now, Tony Wilhoit, I'm grateful to, because he had started and made big inroads with a lot of folks. And but he had started the work of trying to educate and create a fervor. It's what we were looking for, an enthusiasm, which we did not have. We were trying to create that in the minds of people who had controlled the purse strings and wanting to get them to get involved in providing the mechanisms and the funding for the system. So in terms of challenges, I think that was one of the big ones, was to try to teach people why it was needed. What were some of the supports or the enemies of the public defender system, I never did see anybody as an enemy. I saw people that, as far as I was concerned, either misinformed or they didn't understand what the system was about and why it was necessary, why it was important. Perhaps there were some people who were dead set against it. They certainly didn't acknowledge that to me.
Yeah.
It's like one of those things, you don't wake up in the morning and say, well, I'm going to go out and sin today. You don't do that.
Yeah.
You do it inadvertently or by negligence or by not paying attention to what you're doing. People just didn't see the importance of it. Attitudes was a problem. I had the interesting circumstance illustrated by a gentleman that I had practiced before in Pike County, who was a circuit judge, who later went on the Court of Appeals of Kentucky before we had a Supreme Court. And he said to me directly, when I was the public defender and we were doing a lot of appeals, we had a very active appellate section, and that was our main function to start with, was doing appeals. Mm-hmm. Local appointed counsel would handle cases at the local level, and we would handle appeals. Farley, is there some way that you can let us know which of these appeals you're serious about? And I said, Judge, as far as I'm concerned, we're serious about every one of them we file. And he said, well, there's just way too many of them. We've got to have some way to weed them out. I want you to let us know which ones you're really serious about. And I said, I don't think that's fair. And plus, I can't think of any mechanism for doing that. And the other thing of it is, he was relating to the fact, why do you want to provide appeals for these, implying these heinous criminals, you know, that come before us? And I said, well, if it was your son or daughter that was accused of a crime, you could probably go pay somebody to represent them. And what kind of appeal would you want from that lawyer that you hired?
Yeah.
And he acknowledged that he'd want a really good, thorough, vigorous defense and a vigorous advocacy on the part of his son or daughter who was accused of a crime. And I said, well, I think Constitution and the case law requires the same for people who cannot afford to pay for a lawyer. That is the ruling of Argersinger versus Hamlin, and that's what's, I think, included in the Fourth Amendment. And he said he never would concede the point. Never conceded the point. But that was the kind of thing. If you had a judge of the Court of Appeal saying, which ones are you serious about? You know, you understand. Yeah. You had a tall mountain to climb.
Yeah.
Changes and organizational changes. I was talking to Ernie Lewis yesterday, and he said something about organizational charts. It seemed like to these folks that were working with us, Ed and Ernie, who were young guys and starting out with us in the early days, that we were doing a new org chart every week. And I was one of these nuts. I guess I'd been in the federal apparatus too long that I had to have it on paper. I wanted, if we were going to have a hierarchy, I wanted to see what it was. I wanted to see. So that was my thrust, and Ernie mentions this in his article, that we were talking about bringing some org chart for the whole system. I think we finally counted up. We had over 300 lawyers, appointed lawyers, filing invoices for pay throughout the state at one time, over 300 lawyers involved. And I wanted to know who they were, I wanted to know where they were, and I wanted them to come to training, and we began to have these annual trainings. I think Tony had already started annual trainings.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing it, we continued that, and tried to magnify and get people, the best people from around the country, to do the training. We wanted to establish the offices. One of the organizational issues that came up early on, and this was well before the Public Advocacy Commission, and pointed up the need for the establishment of an oversight body like the commission is today, was, and one of the things I personally chafed about, and all, as we sat around the council tables, we chafed about, was the part that we were administratively attached to the Department of Justice cabinet. And my, as long as my friend Jack Smith was Secretary of Justice, that seemed to work out pretty good. But when Neil John Welch became Secretary of the Justice Cabinet, it didn't go as well. Not that he ever necessarily did anything that I can remember specifically, but he was a gentleman who had come to us from the New York, I think it was the New York office of the FBI. And he had been instrumental in one of those big, big, huge sting operations the FBI pulled off so successfully, and I'm glad. I mean, he was a really effective law enforcement person. But his idea of public defender was not very well developed. One day I had a conversation with Neil John, and he said, I don't understand, Farley, why we need the Fourth Amendment in this country. They do without that in Canada. They don't have that in Canada. They get along fine. And I said, I was so incredulous, I really had no really adequate response. You know, the fact that somebody would say something about not needing the Fourth Amendment, which I felt like was a pillar of our whole constitutional system, you understand? So that, to me, pointed up the necessity for some kind of body that stood between us and who, whatever cabinet we are part of. And if you look back at our history, the Public Advocacy Office has been, at that time, Justice, and then Public Protection, and then, I don't know where you are now.
Justice.
Back to Justice, yes. Again. We had the State Police and Corrections, and we were attached for administrative purposes, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. And we were always questioning what does attached for administrative purposes means. So we were always fussing about it. I remember the first meeting of the Justice Cabinet that I attended, and I was going to pull that today, and I didn't get a chance to. I sat at the end of the table, and the guy, I forgot that man's name, who was Commissioner of Corrections, said, what are you sitting way down there for, Farley? And I said, well, I thought I might be asked to come up higher. And nobody at the table understood the reference, and I knew I was among the Philistines for sure. Because nobody understood what I was talking about. I was hoping I would be called into the body as a full council member, you know.
Yeah.
Zug and Carroll, at the time of two cabinet meetings, that used to, not long after he appointed me, referred to me as the loyal opposition. But at least he understood the principles.
Yeah.
He understood the principles of having a public defender and an effective system. And I guess that's the overriding principle that we were trying to give real credence to, was building a system, a systematic approach to a public defender providing defense of innocent persons accused of crime, which we didn't seem to have. And Tony struggled with that, and we all struggled with it in the early days, trying to make a system out of something that was really amorphous and very loose and very casual. Yeah. And we couldn't afford to be casual with people's lives, and that was the thing that we had to try to instill in the system. So we needed an oversight body, and later, fortunately, I don't think it was established in the last year or so of my term, but soon thereafter we had this commission, Public Advocacy Commission, that could be both a barrier and an advocacy group for us to try to intercede for us in the legislature and with the executive, chief executive branch and all those people. We learned from NLADA and others, and as we observe systems across the country, or the lack thereof, more often the total lack thereof, even today in 2012, in so many, many states that I'm sure who pride themselves on being modern and up to date and still don't have structured systems. we felt like we needed to do that in Kentucky. And of course, we had this Bradshaw v. Ball, which was instrumental. With Arkasinger at the federal level and Bradshaw v. Ball here, we were the leaders. We were on the cutting edge of trying to establish a system, and full-time offices just seemed the better way to go. We needed to focus on training. We needed to focus on professionalism. We needed to focus on people who were doing what they did because they loved to do it. I always saw it as a calling, a voco in the Latin sense, vocation, voco, a calling, something you're called upon to do. And, I mean, look at Ed Monahan. How many total years since 83 did you first come on board? And I know you've done some other things in between.
75,
that's right, 75. Imagine, 37 years. I was just thinking today, Ernie was public advocate for 12 years and I was for 8. We've had, us two alone, served half of the life of this agency, 20 years. Anyway, full-time offices just seemed to me like it was something that was needed and we needed to build a system. The NLADA did have involvement. We were involved with NLADA on a national basis. I was talking to Ernie Lewis today or yesterday about some of his consultations and looking at systems across the country. We did some of that too. I went on an assistance project in Connecticut. We went to look at the whole state of Connecticut. Also did a technical assistance project in Alpena, Michigan, to look at local systems there to try to help them improve. And we were kind of like, in the early days, I used to joke, I didn't know what a public defender was, and now I are one. That was sort of that kind of thing with these systems up there. And we were interested, too, in developing record-keeping systems, or I was, because I wanted, as I said a while ago, I wanted to know who these people were. We developed, we experimented for days and weeks with a proper kind of invoice for people to record their time on. And we struggled with having it be using, did we use carbon copies or did we use NCR paper? NCR paper is not the company NCR. NCR just means no carbon required. Paper that wrote you could write through, and we would insist it on. The local public defenders bellyached and screamed and hollered about it. What was it, 8 pages thick or something like that? Well, that's the only kind of record keeping we could begin to gather, and we began to do that. We worked on, Ernie mentioned in the article, the amicus system, which was a way of allocating time. What we were trying to do was, how could we go to the legislature and give them empirical information about what was needed in terms of caseloads, workloads, if we didn't know how much work was being done? So it seemed to me axiomatic that we start out to try to gather information from the people who were doing the work. How much work? How much time? One of the things we were looking for and experimented with, and I don't know whether it's been solved yet, maybe it has, was how much time did the average case take? How much time did a death penalty case take, or a serious felony case, or a misdemeanor case? We were trying to allocate time to public defenders to give them credits with regard to the money. They were working, if I recall correctly, at the magnificent sum of $20 an hour out of court and $30 an hour in court, it seemed to me like. Maybe it was lower than that to start with. I don't remember. Something like that, wasn't it? But we wanted to know how much work were they doing so we could go to the legislature and say, this requires, well, here we have, what was it? I think when I came on board, we were doing something like 35,000 cases a year total. When I first came on board, or when Tony came on board at least, we didn't know how many cases there were. And so we had to find out how many there were. So we were looking for cases and records. We developed an invoice, as I said. We tried to establish better accounting, more accountability. We tried to establish mechanisms, systems. For example, we, as I said a while ago, we were doing appeals, a lot of appeals. Mm-hmm. And when I first came to the office, the secretaries were typing appeals to the Court of Appeals on paper masters that could not, you could not make an error on them. And then that paper master, we were one step removed from the mimeograph machine, and we were putting those paper masters on the roll of an offset printing machine and running off the briefs. That's how we did it. And the secretaries were really grateful to have the latest advance in IBM typewriters with the little balls, the little Selectric balls that are now in museums only. But that's what they had. And I thought, somehow, we've got to do better than that. We had a real challenge to start with when we got, what was a copy at Xerox? The first Xerox machine we had, I think, was a Xerox 915. It was as big as half of this table. And the first hurdle we had to mount and accomplish was getting the Court of Appeals to accept a brief runoff on a copying machine. Now, this sounds like the Dark Ages, but that was a battle. Because how had they been getting them? They had been getting them printed. In the old days, a lawyer who submitted a brief to the Court of Appeals had to go to a local printer. And the printer printed a page in a specific little format, like a little booklet. Yeah. And that's what they were used to getting, and by golly, that's what they were going to continue to get. We finally convinced them that we had way too many cases to do that. Plus, we didn't have a budget to pay for secretaries, let alone pay for the printing of briefs. Mm-hmm. So that was a hurdle that we overcame in the very earliest days. Now, as we began that march to word processing, the first dedicated word processing machine cost $27,000. We had one in the whole office, and it was, again, bigger than the copying machine. And we had to program it specially. It seems unbelievable today that that was within only less than 40 years ago that we had this. And we had attorneys out in the field and in my office. Uh-huh. Farley, why are you giving money to get word processing machines? We need more lawyers. And I said, yes, we need more lawyers, but we need to also be able to furnish these briefs. And we need to do these tons of briefs that we've got to do in a more effective and more efficient way. And so gradually, we were able to persuade them. And we did not have a dedicated word processor. Now, for example, you have a computer sitting on the table here. You have a system, you have a software system now that provides word processing. That was unknown to us in 1975. Think about that. Yeah. I had just come from the feds, and we were keeping computer records on computer punch cards. We were keeping records on punch cards and running them off on an IBM 407 accounting machine and sorting the cards and printing them out by hand. We had hardwired boards. Now, this was in 1971, 72. Before I came here to get back to Kentucky. Oh, the Dark Ages. Anyway, we had to pull all that stuff together. Gradually, we got dedicated word processors. The reinstitution of the death penalty. And I just don't remember. You'll have to ask these other guys who are working more closely with the death penalty. I was really, really focusing on administration and the system needs and that kind of thing. I was concerned about it. I know we did have a great big argument with the Court of Appeals in a case that I'm going to mention in a minute when we talk about significant cases because we were trying to get records from them. Federal legislation had been passed at some point in time that required a separate arm, a separate advocacy arm for the developmentally disabled. And the developmentally disabled, there was a whole enlisted bunch of things like epilepsy and some other things. I can't even remember all of them. A huge list of things that could happen to you that had to manifest itself before 18. And then those people, feds were providing money for services for those people. And then there had to be a separate arm, advocacy arm, to advocate on behalf of those people to get those services. And so that was assigned to our office, the Office of Public Defender, and that's when we changed the name to Public Advocacy, because we had that role too. Okay. And that was given to us, and we took it on. And it seemed to be a natural thing, and I felt like we were struggling to be advocates for people. We needed a body that was sympathetic and understood what it was we were about. We needed a body to be the champion for what we regarded as our cause, that is, to provide effective public assistance of counsel. That's the key word, effective. That is, lawyering that was really effective. Didn't mean we were going to get an acquittal in every case, but it meant that we were going to do the very best we possibly could, and the people were going to be well trained, and they were going to know what they were doing, and they were going to use scientific method and whatever kind, other kinds of available. We wanted to be cutting edge in terms of lawyering, providing the best kind of representation that we could. The commission was going to be the sounding board and also the advocates for us, and they have been all along, as far as I understand. Funding and workload realities continued all that time. I remember going to the legislature. The year, the budget, I mentioned that a while ago. We were talking about per capita funding. We were looking for at least a dollar a head, and I think the population of Kentucky at that time was less than 3 million. And I think our funding was less than that to start with. We weren't getting even a dollar per person in the whole state. And as I mentioned, the $20 an hour and $30 an hour rate always is a problem, because caseloads were growing and growing and growing. I don't know what it was, Ernie, by the time I left. It seemed like it was in the neighborhood of 40,000 or 50,000 cases when I left. And I don't know how many it is now, but it bound to be huge. We just looked, I remember standing in the floor of the House, I think it was. Those are interesting days. Wasn't even in a committee room. I was in the House chamber itself, one of the budget presentations that I made from a lectern in the House, and leadership was up here in the House of General Assembly of Kentucky, and making presentations and asking them. The big push was to try to take up and continued the funding that LEAA had started to be able to have the full-time offices. And it seemed like they answered the call for a while, but then later it kind of diminished. They didn't continue to see the efficacy of that. Reappointment to my second term in 83, from 83 to 87 or 88. I didn't see what was, that's not the right years. 75 would have been about 79, I guess, somewhere 79 or 80 for the second term. I don't remember it being a problem. I just don't remember how it happened. I said to somebody, since I've been here at this meeting, Martha Lane Collins, but I don't think that's right. I think it was Governor Carroll who reappointed me, I think. And we'd have to look back at terms of governors to know, and I don't know that it's significant one way or the other. But I didn't remember any problem. For a person who seemed to be at least or was made aware of political realities when I first became a public defender, the state public defender, I was decidedly an ingenue while I was there, because I didn't really pay attention to the kind of politics that one probably needed to. As I said, I've referred to a while ago, they told me in 83 I wasn't going to be reappointed, and I didn't do anything about it, Even if I'd known what to do, I didn't do anything about it. But at any rate, I would have liked to have continued, because I was enjoying myself. Yeah. I liked what I was doing. And you remember, I felt called to do it, you mm-hmm. understand? So I felt like I was doing the Lord's work. Bill Ayers, deputy. And Bill Ayer was sort of next in line, as I recall. I don't recall much about how that developed. I know he was a hard worker. He was a lawyer that was in the office. And I think Bill was there when I came, it seems to me like. Tony had hired him, I believe. and a good worker. David Merle was the deputy when I came on board, who was one of the brightest lawyers that I've ever known. And I was going to leave you with a little aphorism here, or a metaphor, or whatever it is, about the blind leading the blind. David Merle was blind. And I was certainly blind because I didn't know what I was doing in the early days. But David paved the way for me in so many ways. He was very effective and a very, very good lawyer. But then Bill came along. I don't remember exactly how that transition was made. But Bill was a very effective deputy also. And he was also mindful of my concern about mechanics. I had lawyers like Ernie Lewis and Ed Monahan who were great, great practitioners, great students of the law. I never regarded myself as a student of the law or really as avid and as skillful a practitioner as any of the lawyers. I always said all the lawyers were a whole lot smarter than me. I was much more concerned, again, about system, about mechanics, and about day-to-day execution, getting the resources, the marshaling and the gathering of resources for the system. We had these folks to talk about and deal with all the cases and the hard work of actually representing clients. Now, I had represented clients before. I didn't get to represent anybody on a single case the whole 8 years. And I probably could have, but it just didn't seem to be my cup of tea. I was more concerned about mechanics. Local assistance branch in 1980. Ernie and I were talking about, was that something you were headed up, the local assistance branch?
Ed headed it up first, and then I headed it up.
Ed. And the reason for that was, again, trying to gather resources, gather training, provide better skills. We were developing lawyers' skill sets, if you will, on how to try cases and how to do it more quickly. They had to be, because caseloads were horrendous, just like they are now. They were horrendous then. We wanted to provide greater more resources, more training. Ed, I think, did you start the newsletter?
Ernie
started the newsletter, and that began... And then early on, one of the things I was concerned, I wanted a newsletter to tell about what we were doing and how to do things. And then what I envisioned was, and they, Ernie, and all of us collectively envisioned, was more of a journal. We wanted more of a law review type thing. Not necessarily a law review in what the law ought to be, but what is the law now? Mm-hmm. What is the very latest decision law, case law decisions that will help you in court? How can you make objections? What is the list of objections you need to have at the tip of your tongue when someone is questioning a witness? So you would be able to call it to mind. I think so often now we have an Awano program in my Baptist church where we're trying to teach young people Bible verses. We were sort of analogizing with that in those early days. We wanted lawyers to be so familiar with the case law and the latest decisions that they can apply them in real time. We were concerned on appeal, cleaning up things that had happened before, but how much better to have somebody ab initio that was applying the latest decision case law in court, on their feet, ready to respond, and that requires training. And we had to have the best kind of training. We had to have scenarios. We had to have moot court stuff. And we began to develop that sort of thing. And we also developed local assistance branch, started the journal. We were looking for the structure. We have to give a lot of credit to the ABA and the NLADA. ABA had standards on providing public defense to defender assistance. We tied into every resource we could think of. We had ABA people come down with that NLADA, and I can't remember to much life of me the man and the woman who were the real principals at NLADA that we dealt with. And I bet you would know, John, who they were. Anyway, we ought to mention them, and I can't remember. But they were very much concerned and interested in what we were doing.
think Marty Crawford was one of them, and a guy named Wilson may have been one of them.
I don't remember.
And then anyway. The Apt Associates came down.
Yes.
Apt.
Yeah. Somebody came up to me yesterday. The guy, is it Schuller, who is in the Louisville?
Pete Schuller.
Came up to me and said, he recalled so vividly something that I had forgotten. One of these groups that we had come in at a training, and the training was to try to make, to give lawyers some acting skills in terms of presenting cases in court, persuasiveness. We were bringing in psychologists to help us be more persuasive, and he says he remembers me being the guinea pig on stage, and I was reacting to the instructions of this instructor and giving facial expressions. And I can't imagine anybody having more histrionics than me already, but they were trying to amplify some of those things, and more importantly, distill them so that you use them at the proper time and that you gave the proper kind of emphasis, kind of like Bright was doing for us yesterday, talking about theory of the case and what do you emphasize and what do you de-emphasize and what are the really significant things you need to bring out in a case and how to do that in terms of effective presentations. And I was a babe in the woods with regard to, listen, I was such a ignoramus when I started in civil trials in Pike County. I ought not to even confess this. I didn't know. See, I trained in Washington, D.C. at the American University, and we trained with federal rules. Yes, I passed the Kentucky Bar, but I didn't even know that a majority verdict, a verdict of nine people in a civil trial was sufficient when I tried my first civil case. And I won, and I didn't realize how I did it. You know, I mean, that kind of thing ought not to be. You ought not to go into trial if you don't know that much. Now, I could have learned, but I didn't know that I didn't know that. You know, if you don't know what you don't know, I mean, how can you find ask questions about it? No, I should have, Bob. Oh, Lord, those are the days. And the Governor's Brown's Task Force on the DPA, something supposedly initiated by Neil John Welch, and I think I blanked that out or something. I don't know. I don't remember. I don't remember the whys and wherefores or why that was necessary. Or why it was done, maybe as a precursor to the commission. I just don't recall. One of the other guys will, or maybe Allison will know about that. We asked the legislature in 1982 to abolish the assigned counsel method, and I think from my review of Ernie's article about my tenure, they did abolish the assigned counsel method, and what we moved to was contract system. What we were trying to do was get more accountability at the local level, at least have identified people. You know, yes. We had various varieties of practice rather than just take ad hoc lists of people who are willing to do this. Let's contract with these five people to do this and that sort of thing. And you know, to get these cases done.
Have names and
specifics. And yes. You all agree to contract the local, particularly when you're dealing with the local fiscal court. Here's a group of your constituents that are going to provide this service for an X dollars per year, you know, that sort of thing. And the reason we asked them to do away the assigned counsel method was because we just thought, and all the research, all of our experience had taught us that this was not the best way to provide effective assistance for counsel. One of the things that we tried to deal with was, by this time dealing with the Supreme Court, trying to get data on their imposition of the death penalty. And today that just seems like, why would they think that they would not have to reveal that information? Why would you have any governmental information that applied to execution of an office in the executive branch or the judicial branch that wouldn't be freely given, provided? And I come from Florida. I live in Florida now, where we have the most active revelation of data and information, governmental information, of any state in the country. It's even more advanced than the Federal Freedom of Information Act. We didn't have that then. Uh-huh. And the Supreme Court said it was, the data was confidential. What we were trying to get at was how many black people, as opposed to white people, were receiving the death penalty. And we wanted to know how that was being done, because we were interested in trying to mount a defense saying what we believed to be the case, which was the case, that black people were being sentenced to death in a much greater number of times than white people. You know, we've had Bright talk about that while we've been here, that sort of thing. But that was... And then I think it was in that case, that I believe it was in that case or one, something like that, that I was told, and I think we filed the action in my name as an individual, and the court told me that I had no special standing to be able to file such an action in my name. And I said, well, you know, I think that's a ruse. You know, I think we could do better. We'll make it. We'll bring in some other group as plaintiffs. How about all the people? I don't know that I thought of this at the time, but I had these brilliant thoughts afterwards, as we so often do. Mm-hmm. After oral argument, you think about all the things you could have said. You know, things like, how about all the people who have suffered and lo these many years at the hands of people imposing the death penalty, you know, or something like that. Or all those similarly situated. What am I searching for? Where you have a whole group of people?
Class action.
A class action here. You know, I didn't think of that at the time. Anyway, that was kind of an awkward situation. Oh, the other interesting one that I regard as most memorable, and I was so troubled today to see and hear about Gail Robinson, because Gail and Kevin were there in the earliest days. Tony, did you hire them? You'd hire both of them. They were already there when I came on board. And frankly, in my fairly sheltered upbringing, I had never known people like Gail and Kevin. And I say that in a good way. People who were such fearless advocates. Well, I learned it and saw it in Ernie and Ed and people we had there. But those two together were, I mean, a formidable team. But what I'm leading up to is, for some reason, we saw fit. Now imagine, Ernie and Gail and I think that was the three, we decided we were going to go to Washington, D.C. and appear before the Senate of the United States, the Senate Judiciary Committee. Joe Biden was in the Senate so long, he may have been on the committee at the time. I know Wendell Ford was. And they had an appointment from Eastern Kentucky, a guy that had been a prosecutor. I know this is being recorded. I'm not going to mention his name. That was appointed to be the federal district judge. And Gail and Ernie and I decided, based on his record and the reports that we got from his unfairness as a prosecutor and the way he conducted himself as a lawyer in his county, that he did not measure up to the standard of becoming a federal district judge. Mm-hmm. So we decided we were going to go up there and raise the issue. And did you know I still have those proceedings someplace? I have a copy of the proceedings of the panel that I got later. And we testified, and of course they heard us out and listened to us, you know, and went ahead and confirmed the appointment anyway. But Wendell Ford, as he walked out, said something. He said, well, I'm sure you did what you thought you had to do. He was very gracious about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the only words I've ever exchanged with Wendell Ford.
What made you think that a full-time system could work in Eastern Kentucky under some of the most difficult social conditions in America?
I I was an ingenue. I didn't understand that. I probably didn't know. I knew we had difficult social conditions, but I didn't think about that as a barrier necessarily. I just knew that that's what was needed so desperately. I felt like if we grouped enough places together, and really an awkward situation in terms of transportation too. That was the other difficult thing. You couldn't group too many counties together because in Pike County, for example, it took an hour and 20 minutes to get from one side of the county to the other on the roads we had in 1975. So I don't know. I just didn't think about that as a problem. I just knew that it was so desperately needed, some kind of structure. And also probably I was influenced by the fact that at the time the feds, the LEAA, and the Appalachian Regional Commission, if you remember that, the Appalachian Regional Commission, John, you remember, was not supposed to fund bricks and mortar projects. But we told the Appalachian Regional Commission, which was a federal agency, this is sort of at the offshoot of the Johnson administration and the Great Society, that we needed roads. And we needed roads. And I felt like if we could get roads and tie things together, then we could work those groups, those counties together. I don't know that I perceived what those problems were. I just felt like the need was so great to have more structure, to have people who really were responsive, because I saw too many times lawyers who were in private practice, although well-intentioned, they did not want to antagonize a judge. And we continue to have that problem.